never interviewed anybody called Tamara, without even giving it any thought. 20 years is a long time, and you must have interviewed quite a number of people. I don't think you'd be able to recall so quickly whether one of them was or wasn't named Tamara. She shakes her head and takes another sip of coffee. A faint smile springs to her lips. Kafka, I... She stops, looking for the right words. I wait for her to find them. I feel as though things are starting to change around me, she says. In what way? I can't really say, but something's happening. The air pressure, the way sounds reverberate, the reflection of light, how bodies move and time passes. It's all transforming, bit by bit. It's like each small change is a drop that's steadily building up into a stream. She picks up her black Mont Blanc pen, looks at it, puts it back where it was, then looks straight at me. What happened between us in your room last night is probably part of that flow. I don't know if what we did last night was right or not, but at the time, I decided not to force myself to judge anything. If the flow is there, I thought I'd just let it carry me along where it wanted. Can I tell you what I think? Go right ahead. I think you're trying to make up for lost time. She thinks about it for a while. You may be right, she says. But how do you know that? Because I'm doing the same thing. Making up for lost time. Yes, I say. A lot of things were stolen from my childhood. Lots of important things. And now I have to get them back. In order to keep on living. I nod. I have to. People need something like a place they can go back to. There's still time to make it, I think. For me, and for you. She closes her eyes, and tenses her fingers on top of her desk. Like she's resigned to it, she opens her eyes again. Who are you? She asks. And why do you know so much about everything? You tell her she must know who you are. I'm Kafka on the shore, you say. Your lover. And your son. The boy named Crow. And the two of us can't be free. We're caught up in a whirlpool. Pulled beyond time. Somewhere, we were struck by lightning. But not the kind of lightning you can see or hear. That night you make love again. You listen as the blank within her is filled. It's a faint sound, like fine sand on a shore crumbling in the moonlight. You hold your breath listening. You're inside your theory now, then you're outside. And inside again, then outside. You inhale, hold it, exhale. Inhale, hold it, exhale. Prince sings on, like some mollusk in your head. The moon rises, the tide comes in. Seawater flows into a river. A branch of the dogwood just outside the window trembles nervously. You hold her close, she buries her face in your chest. You feel her breath against your bare skin. She traces your muscles one by one. And then she gently licks your swollen penis, as if healing it. You come again in her mouth. She swallows it down, as if every drop is precious. You kiss her vagina, touching every soft, warm spot with your tongue. You become someone else there. Something else. You are somewhere else. There's nothing inside me you need to know, she says. Until Monday morning dawns, you hold each other, listening to time passing by.
34. The massive bank of thunderclouds crossed the city at a lethargic pace, letting loose a flurry of lightning bolts as if probing every nook and cranny for a long-lost morality, eventually dwindling to a faint, angry echo from the eastern sky. and right then the violent rain came to a halt, followed by an unearthly silence. Hoshino got up and opened the window to let in some air. The storm clouds had vanished, the sky covered once more by a thin membrane of pale clouds. All the buildings were wet, the moist cracks in their walls dark, like old people's veins. Water dripped from power lines and formed puddles on the ground. Birds flew out from where they'd sought shelter, chirping loudly as they vied for the insects that were out themselves now that the storm had abated. Hoshino rotated his neck from side to side a couple of times, testing his spine. He gave one big stretch, sat down beside the window, and gazed outside, then pulled out his pack of Marlboros and lit up.
"Well, Mr. Nakata, after all your effort to turn the stone over and open the entrance, nothing out of the ordinary happened. No frog appeared, no demons, nothing strange at all. Which is fine by me, of course. The stage was set with all that noisy thunder, but I got to tell you, I'm kind of disappointed."
He didn't get a reply, so he turned round. Nakata was leaning forward with both hands on the floor and his eyes closed. The old man looked like a feeble bug.
"What's the matter? You all right?"
Hoshino asked.
"I'm sorry. I just seem to be a little tired. Nakata doesn't feel so well. I'd like to lie down and sleep for a while."
Nakata's face did look awfully pale. His eyes were sunken, his fingers trembling. Just a few hours was all it took, it seemed, for him to have aged enormously.
"Okay, I'll lay out the futon for you. Feel free to sleep as much as you want,"
Hoshino said.
"But are you sure you're okay? Does your stomach hurt? Do you feel like you're going to puke? Any ringing in your ears? Or maybe you have to take a dump? Or should I get a doctor? Do you have insurance?"
"Yes, the governor gave me an insurance card, and I keep it safe in my bag."
"That's good,"
Hoshino said, dragging the futon out of the cupboard and spreading it flat.
"I know this isn't the time to go into details, but it isn't the governor of Tokyo who gave you the card. It's a national health card, so it's the Japanese government that's issued it to you. I don't know all that much about it, but I'm sure that's the case. The governor himself isn't looking after every little detail of your life, okay? So forget about him for a while."
"Nakata understands. The governor didn't give me the insurance card. I'll try to forget about him for a while. Anyway, I don't think I need a doctor. If I can just get some sleep, I should be all right."
"Wait a sec. You're not going to spring one of those 36-hour marathons, are you?"
"I don't know. I don't decide how long I'm going to sleep and then stick to it."
"Well, I suppose that makes sense," Hoshino admitted. "Nobody does that. Okay, sleep as long as you like. It's been a rough day. All that thunder, plus talking to the stone, right? And that entrance thing opening up? Not something you see every day, that's for sure. You had to use your head a lot, so you must be tired. Don't worry about anything, just relax and catch some shut-eye. Let old Hoshino handle the rest."
"Much obliged. I'm always putting you out, aren't I? Nakata can never thank you enough for all you've done. If you hadn't been with me, I wouldn't have known what to do. And you have your own important work to do."
"Yeah, I guess so,"
Hoshino said in a gloomy voice. So many things had happened, he'd completely forgotten about his job.
"Now that you mention it, I really should be getting back to work soon. The boss is blowing a gasket as we speak, I'll bet. I phoned him and said I had to take a few days off to take care of something, but haven't checked in since. Once I get back, he'll really let me have it."
He lit a fresh Marlboro, leisurely exhaling the smoke. He stared at a crow perched on top of a telephone pole and made silly faces at it.
"But who cares? He can say what he likes, blow steam out of his ears for all I care. Look, I've been doing more than my fair share for years, working my ass off. Hey, Yoshino, we're short-handed, so how about making a night run to Hiroshima? Okay, boss, I'm on it. Always did what they told me to do, never a complaint. Thanks to which my back shot to hell. If you hadn't fixed it for me, things would have gone from bad to worse. I'm only in my mid-twenties, so why should I ruin my health over some crummy job, right? What's wrong with a few days off now and then? But you know, Mr. Nakata, I—"
Hoshino suddenly realized the old man was sound asleep. Eyes shut tight, face pointed towards the ceiling, lips firmly pressed together, Nakata was breathing peacefully. The flipped-over stone lay near his pillow.
"Wow, I've never seen anyone fall asleep as fast as him," Hoshino thought admiringly.
With time on his hands, he stretched out and watched some television, but he couldn't stand any of the insipid afternoon programs, so he decided to go out. He had no clean underwear left and needed to buy some. He detested washing clothes. Better to buy some cheap underpants, he always thought, than bother with washing the old scuzzy ones. He went to the front desk of the inn to pay for the next day, and told them his companion was asleep and they weren't to wake him up. "Not that you could if you tried," he added. He wandered the streets, sniffing the post-rain scent in the air, dressed in his usual dragon's cap, green-tinted Ray-Bans, and a lower shirt. He picked up a newspaper at a kiosk at the station and checked how the dragons were doing. They lost to Hiroshima in an away game. Then checked the film schedule and decided to see the latest Jackie Chan. The timing was perfect. He asked directions at the police box and found out it was close by, so he walked. He bought his ticket, went inside and watched the film, munching on peanuts. When he came out of the film, it was already evening. He wasn't all that hungry, but since he couldn't think of anything else to do, he decided to have dinner. He popped into a place nearby and ordered sushi and a beer. He was more tired than he realized, and only drank half the beer. "That makes sense, though," he thought. "Lifting that heavy stone, of course I'm worn out. I feel like the oldest of the three little pigs. All the mean old wolf's got to do is huff and puff, and I'll be blasted all the way to Okayama." He left the sushi bar and happened across a pachinko place. Before he knew it, he was down 2,000 yen. He reckoned it just wasn't his day, so he gave up on pachinko and wandered around. He remembered that he still hadn't bought any underwear. "Damn, that was the whole point of going out," he told himself. He went into a discount store in the shopping district and bought underpants, white T-shirts and socks. Now he could finally toss out his dirty underwear. He decided it was about time for a new Aloha shirt, and scoured a few shops, looking for one, only to conclude that the pickings in Takamatsu were pretty slim. Summer and winter alike, he always wore Aloha shirts, but that didn't mean just any Aloha shirt would do. He stopped at a nearby bakery and bought some bread, in case Nakata woke up hungry in the middle of the night, as well as a small carton of orange juice. Next, he went to a bank and used the ATM to withdraw 50,000 yen. Checking his balance, he found there was still quite a lot left. These past few years had been so busy that he'd hardly had time to spend any money. By this time, it was completely dark, and he had a sudden yearning for a cup of coffee. He looked around, spotting a sign for a cafe just off the main drag. It turned out to be the kind of old-fashioned coffee shop you don't find much anymore. He went inside, settled himself onto a soft, comfortable chair, and ordered a cup. Chamber music filtered out of the solid, British-made walnut speakers. Hoshino was the only customer. He sank back in his chair, and for the first time in quite a while, felt completely at ease. Everything in the shop was calming, natural, easy to feel comfortable with. The coffee, served in a fancy cup, was rich and delicious. Hoshino closed his eyes, breathing in quietly, and listened to the intertwining of strings and piano. He'd hardly ever listened to classical music before, but it was soothing and put him in an introspective mood. Sunk back in his soft chair, eyes closed, lost in the music, a number of thoughts crossed his mind, mostly having to do with himself. The more he thought about himself, though, the less reality his existence seemed to have. He began to feel like some meaningless appendage sitting there. "I've always been a great fan of the Chunichi Dragons," he thought. "But what are the dragons to me, anyway? Say they beat the giants. How's that going to make me a better person? How could it? So why the hell have I spent all this time getting worked up as if the team was some extension of myself?" "Mr. Nakata said he's empty. Maybe he is, for all I know. But what does that make me? He said an accident when he was little made him that way, empty. But I never had an accident. If Mr. Nakata's empty, that makes me worse than empty. At least he has something about him. Whatever it was that made me drop everything and follow him to Shikoku. Don't ask me what that something is, though." Hoshino ordered a second cup of coffee. "You like our coffee, then?" the grey-haired owner came over and asked. Hoshino didn't know this, of course, but he used to be an official in the Ministry of Education. After retirement, he came back to his hometown of Takamatsu and opened this coffee shop, where he made fine coffee and played classical music.
It's great. Such a nice aroma.
I roast the beans myself, select each bean individually.
No wonder it's so good.
The music doesn't bother you?
The music? Hoshino replied. No, it's great. I don't mind it at all, not one bit. Who's playing?
The Rubinstein, Heifetz and Feuermann trio. The million-dollar trio, they were dubbed consummate artists. This is a 1941 recording, but the brilliance hasn't faded.
It really hasn't. Good things never grow old, do they?
Some people prefer a more structured, classical, straightforward version of the Archduke trio, like the Oistrakh trio's version.
No, I think this one's nice, Hoshino said. It has a, I don't know, gentle feel to it.
Thank you very much, the owner said, thanking him on behalf of the million-dollar trio, and went back behind the counter.
As Hoshino enjoyed his second cup, he went back to his reflections.
But I am helping Mr. Nakata out. I read things for him, and I was the one who found the stone after all. I've hardly ever noticed this before, but it feels kind of nice to be helpful to someone. I don't regret any of it, skipping work, coming over to Shikoku, all those crazy things happening one after another. I feel I'm exactly where I belong. When I'm with Mr. Nakata, I can't be bothered with all this who am I stuff. Maybe this is going overboard, but I bet Buddha's followers and Jesus' apostles felt the same way. When I'm with the Buddha, I always feel where I belong. Something like that. Forget about culture, truth, all that junk. That kind of inspiration's what it's all about. When I was little, Grandpa told me stories about Buddha's disciples. One of them was named Myoga. The guy was a total moron and couldn't memorize even the simplest sutra. The other disciples always teased him. One day the Buddha said to him, "Myoga, you're not very bright, so you don't have to learn any sutras. Instead, I'd like you to sit at the entrance and polish everybody's shoes." Myoga was an obedient guy, so he didn't tell his master to go screw himself. So for 10 years, 20 years, he diligently polished everybody's shoes. Then one day he achieved enlightenment and became one of the greatest of all the Buddha's followers.
That's a story Hoshino always remembered, because he thought that had to be the crappiest kind of life, polishing shoes for decades. You've got to be kidding, he thought. When he considered it now, though, the story started to take on a different undertone.
Life's crappy no matter how you cut it.
He just hadn't understood that when he was little. These thoughts occupied him till the music, which was helping him meditate, stopped playing.
"Hey!" he called out to the owner. "What was that music called again? I forget."
"Beethoven's Archduke Trio."
"March Duke?"
"Arch. Archduke. Beethoven dedicated it to the Austrian Archduke Rudolf. It's not the official name, more like the piece's nickname. Rudolf was the son of Emperor Leopold II. He was a very skilled musician who studied piano and music theory with Beethoven starting when he was 16. He looked after Beethoven. Archduke Rudolf didn't make a name for himself as either a pianist or a composer, but sort of stood in the shadows, lending a helping hand to Beethoven, who didn't know much about getting ahead in the world. If it hadn't been for him, Beethoven would have had a much tougher time.
Those kind of people are necessary in life, eh?
Absolutely.
The world would be a real mess if everybody was a genius. Somebody's got to keep watch, take care of business.
Exactly. A world full of geniuses would have significant problems.
I really like that piece.
It's beautiful. You never get tired of listening to it. I'd say it's the most refined of all Beethoven's piano trios. He wrote it when he was 40 and never wrote another. He must have decided he'd reached the pinnacle in the genre.
I think I know what you mean. Reaching the pinnacle's important in everything, Hoshino said.
Please come again.
Yeah, I'll do that.
When he got back to the room, Nakata was, as expected, out cold. He'd gone through this before, so this time it didn't strike him as odd. Just let him sleep as much as he wants, he decided. The stone was still there, right next to his pillow, and Hoshino put his bag of bread down beside it. He took a bath and changed into his new underwear, then balled up his old set inside a paper bag and tossed it in the bin. He crawled into his futon and was soon sound asleep.
He woke up the next morning just before 9. Nakata was still asleep, his breathing quiet and regular. Oshino went to eat breakfast alone, asking the maid not to wake up his companion. "You can leave the futon like it is," he said.
"Is he all right, sleeping that long?"
the maid asked. "Don't worry, he's not about to die on us. He needs to sleep to regain his strength. I know what's best for him." He bought a paper at the station and sat on a bench and looked through the film listings. A cinema near the station was having a François Truffaut retrospective. Oshino had no idea who Truffaut was, or even if it was a man or a woman, but a double feature was a good way of killing time till evening, so he decided to go. The featured films were The 400 Blows and Shoot the Pianist. There were only a handful of customers in the cinema. Oshino was by no means a movie buff. Occasionally he'd go and see one, a kung fu or action film. So these early works of Truffaut were over his head, the pace, as you'd expect of older films, a bit sluggish. Still, he enjoyed the original mood, the overall look of the films, how suggestively the characters' inner worlds were portrayed. At the very least, he wasn't bored. "I wouldn't mind seeing some more films by that guy," he told himself afterwards. He left the cinema, walked to the shopping district, and found the same coffee shop as the night before. The owner remembered him. Oshino sat in the same chair and ordered coffee. Once more, he was the only customer. Something with stringed instruments was playing on the stereo.
"Haydn's first cello concerto. Pierre Fournier's playing the solo," the owner explained as he brought over his coffee.
"It's a really natural sound," Oshino commented.
"It is, isn't it?" the owner said. "Pierre Fournier is one of my absolute favorite musicians. Like an elegant wine, his playing has an aroma and substance that warms the blood and gently encourages you. I always refer to him as Maestro Fournier out of respect. I don't know him personally, of course, but I've always felt as though he were my mentor."
Listening to Fournier's flowing, dignified cello, Oshino was drawn back to his childhood. He used to go to the river every day to catch fish.
"Nothing to worry about back then," he reminisced. "Just live each day as it came. As long as I was alive, I was something. That was just how it was. But somewhere along the way it all changed. Living turned me into nothing. Weird. People are born in order to live, right? But the longer I've lived, the more I've lost what's inside me, and ended up empty. And I bet the longer I live, the emptier, the more worthless I'll become. Something's wrong with this picture. Life isn't supposed to turn out like this. Isn't it possible to shift direction, to change where I'm headed?"
"Excuse me,"
Hoshino called out to the owner of the cash register.
"Can I help you?"
"I was wondering if you had time. Could you come over and talk to me? I'd like to know more about this Haydn guy."
The owner was happy to give a mini-lecture on Haydn, the man and his music. He was basically a reserved sort of person, but when it came to classical music he was eloquent. He explained how Haydn became a hired musician, serving different patrons over his long life, creating who knows how many compositions to order. Haydn was practical, affable, humble and generous, he said, yet also a complex person with a silent darkness all his own inside.
"Haydn was an enigmatic figure. Nobody can know the amount of intense pathos he held inside him. In the feudal time he was born in, though, he was compelled to skilfully cloak his ego in submissiveness and display a bright, happy exterior. Otherwise he would have been crushed. A lot of people compare him unfavorably to Bach and Mozart, both his music and the way he lived. Over his long life he was innovative, to be sure, but never exactly on the cutting edge. But if you really pay attention as you listen, you can catch a hidden longing for the modern ego. Like a far-off echo full of contradictions, it's all there in Haydn's music, silently pulsating. Listen to that chord. Hear it? It's very quiet, right? But it has a persistent, inward-moving spirit that's filled with a pliant, youthful sort of curiosity."
"Like François Truffaut's films?"
"Exactly," the owner exclaimed happily, patting Hoshino's arm reflexively. "You've hit it right on the head. You find the same spirit animating Truffaut, a persistent, inward-moving spirit that's filled with a pliant, youthful sort of curiosity," he repeated.
When the Haydn concerto was over, Hoshino asked him to play the Rubinstein Heifetz Feuermann version of the Archduke trio again. While listening to this, he again was lost in thought.
"Damn it, I don't care what happens," he decided. "I'm going to follow Mr. Nakata as long as I live. To hell with the job!"
35. When the phone rings at 7 a.m., I'm still sound asleep. In my dream, I was deep inside a cave, bent over in the dark, torch in hand, searching for something. I hear a voice far away at the cave's entrance, calling a name faintly. I shout a reply, but whoever it is doesn't seem to hear me. The person calls my name over and over. Reluctantly, I stand up and start heading for the entrance. A little longer, and I would have found it, I think. But inside, I'm also relieved I didn't find it. That's when I wake up. I look around, collecting the scattered bits of my consciousness. I realize the phone's ringing, the phone at the library's reception desk. Bright sunlight's shining in through the curtains, and Miss Saiki's no longer next to me. I'm alone in bed. I get out of bed in my t-shirt and boxers and go out to the phone. It takes me a while to get there, but the phone keeps on ringing. "Hello?" "Were you asleep?" Oshima asks.
"Yeah."
"Sorry to get you up so early on a day off, but we've got a problem."
"A problem?"
"I'll tell you about it later, but you'd better not hang around here for a while. We're going to head off soon, so get your things together. When I get there, just come out to the car park and get right in the car without saying anything, okay?" "Okay," I reply. I go back to my room and pack. There's no need to rush, since it only takes 5 minutes to get ready. I take down the laundry I had hanging in the bathroom, stuff my wash bag, books and diary in my backpack, then get dressed and straighten up the bed. Pull the sheets tight, plump up the pillows, straighten out the covers, covering up all traces of what went on there. I sit down in the chair and think about Miss Saiki, who'd been with me until a few hours before. I have time for a quick bowl of cornflakes. Wash up the bowl and spoon and put them away. Brush my teeth, wash my face. I'm checking out my face in the mirror when I hear the Miata pull into the car park. Even though the weather's perfect, Oshima has the tan top up. I shoulder my back, walk over to the car, and climb into the passenger seat. As before, Oshima does a good job of tying my pack down on the rack. He's wearing a pair of Armani-type sunglasses and a striped linen shirt over a white V-neck T-shirt, white jeans, and a navy blue low-cut Converse All-Stars. Casual day-off clothes. He hands me a navy blue cap with a North Face logo on it. "Didn't you say you'd lost your hat somewhere? Use this one. It'll help hide your face a little." "Thanks," I say, and tug on the cap. Oshima looks me over in the cap and nods his approval. "You have sunglasses, right?" I nod, take my sky blue Revos from my pocket, and put them on. "Very cool," he says. "Try putting the cap on backwards." I do as he says, turning the cap round. Oshima nods again. "Great, you look like a rap singer from a nice family." He shifts to first, revs the engine and lets out the clutch. "Where are we going?" I ask. "The same place as before. The mountains in Kochi." Oshima nods. "Right. Another long drive." He flips on the stereo. It's a cheerful Mozart orchestral piece I've heard before. The Posthorn Serenade, maybe? "Are you tired of the mountains?" "No, I like it there. It's quiet, and I can get a lot of reading done." "Good," Oshima says. "So what was the problem you mentioned?" Oshima shoots a sullen look at the rearview mirror, glances over at me, then faces forward again. "First of all, the police got back in touch with me. Phoned my place last night. Sounds like they're getting serious about tracking you down. They seemed pretty intense about the whole thing. But I have an alibi, don't I?" "Yes, you do. A solid alibi. The day the murder took place, you were in Shikoku. They don't doubt that. What they're thinking is that you might have conspired with somebody else." conspired. You might have had an accomplice. Accomplice? I shake my head. Where'd they get that idea? They're pretty tight-lipped about it. They're pushy about asking questions, but get all low-key when you try turning the tables on them. So I spent the whole night online downloading information. Did you know there are a couple of websites up already about the case? You're pretty famous. The Wandering Prince Who Holds the Key to the Puzzle. I give a small shrug. The Wandering Prince? With online information, it's hard to separate fact from wishful thinking, but you could summarize it like this. The police are now after a man in his late 60s. The night of the murder, he turned up at a police box near the Nogata shopping district and confessed to having just murdered somebody in the neighborhood. Said he stabbed him. But he spouted out all kinds of nonsense, so the young officer on the beat tagged him as crazy and sent him on his way without getting the whole story. Of course, when the murder came to light, the policeman knew he'd blown it. He hadn't taken down the old man's name or address, and if his superiors heard about it, they'd be hell to pay, so he kept quiet. But something happened. I have no idea what, and the whole thing came to light. The officer was disciplined, of course. Poor guy'll probably never live it down. Ushima changes gear to pass a white Toyota Tercel, then nimbly slips back into his lane. The police went all out and were able to identify the old man. They don't know his background, but he appears to be mentally impaired. Not retarded, just a teeny bit off. He lives by himself on welfare and some support from relatives. But he's disappeared from his apartment. The police traced his movements and think he was hitchhiking, heading for Shikoku. An intercity bus driver thinks he might have taken his bus out of Kobe. He remembered him because he had an unusual way of talking and said some weird things. Apparently he was with some young guy in his mid-20s. The two of them got out at Tokushima Station. They've located the inn where they stayed, and according to a housekeeper, they took a train to Takamatsu. The old man's movements and yours overlap exactly. Both of you left Nogata in Nakano Ward and headed directly for Takamatsu. A little too much of a coincidence, so naturally the police are reading something into it, thinking that the two of you planned the whole thing together. The National Police Agency's even getting in on the act, and now they're scouring the city. We might not be able to hide you at the library anymore, so I decided you better lie low in the mountains. A mentally impaired old man from Nakano. Ring any bells? I shake my head. None. His address isn't far from your house. A 15-minute walk, apparently. But tons of people live in Nakano. I don't even know who lives next door. There's more, Ushima says, and glances at me. He's the one who made all those mackerel and sardines rain down from the sky in the Nogata shopping district. At least, he predicted to the policeman that lots of fish would fall from the sky the day before it happened. That's amazing, I say. Isn't it? Ushima says. And the same day, in the evening, a huge amount of leeches rained down on the Fujigawa rest stop on the Tomei Highway. Remember? Yeah, I do. None of this escaped the police, of course. They're guessing there's got to be some connection between these events and this mystery man they're looking for. His movements run so closely parallel to everything. The Mozart piece ends, and another begins. Hands on the steering wheel, Ushima shakes his head a couple of times. A really strange turn of events. It started out weird and is getting even weirder as it goes along. Impossible to predict what'll happen next. One thing's for sure, though. Everything seems to be converging right here. The old man's path and yours are bound to cross. I close my eyes and listen to the roar of the engine. Maybe I should go to some other town, I tell him. Apart from everything else, I don't want to cause any more trouble for you or Miss Sayaki. But where would you go? I don't know, but I can work it out if you take me to the station. It doesn't really matter. Ushima sighs. I don't think that's such a smart idea. The station's got to be crawling with police. All on the lookout for a cool, tall, 15-year-old boy lugging a backpack and a stack of obsessions. So why not take me to a station far away, that they're not staking out? It's all the same. In the end, they'll find you. I don't say anything. Look, they haven't issued a warrant for your arrest. You're not on the most wanted list or anything, okay? I nod. Which means you're still free. So I don't need anybody's permission to take you anywhere I want. I'm not breaking the law. I mean, I don't even know your real first name, Kafka. So don't worry about me. I'm a very cautious person. Nobody's going to nab me so easily. Oshima, I say. Yes? I didn't plan anything with anybody. If I had to kill my father, I wouldn't ask anybody to do it. I know. He stops at a red light and checks the rearview mirror, then pops a lemon drop into his mouth and offers me one. I slip it into my mouth. What comes after that? What do you mean? Oshima asks. You said, first of all, about why I have to go and hide in the hills. If there's a first reason, there's got to be a second. Oshima stares at the red light, but it doesn't change. Compared to the first, the second isn't very important. I still want to hear it. It's about Miss Sayaki, he says. The light finally turns green and he accelerates away. You're sleeping with her, right? I don't know how to answer that. Don't worry. I'm not blaming you or anything. I just have a sense for these things, that's all. She's a wonderful person, a very attractive lady. She's special in all sorts of ways. She's a lot older than you, for sure, but so what? I understand your attraction to her. You want to have sex with her, so why not? She wants to have sex with you. More power to her. It doesn't bother me. If you guys are okay with that, it's fine by me. Oshima rolls the lemon drop around in his mouth. But I think it's best if you two keep your distance for a while. And I don't mean because of that bloody mess in Nakano. Why then? She's in a very delicate place right now. How so? Miss Sayaki, he begins, searching for the rest. What I mean is, she's dying. I've felt it for a long time. I raise my sunglasses and look at him closely. He's looking straight ahead as he drives. We've turned onto the highway to Kochi. This time, surprisingly, he keeps to the speed limit. A Toyota Supra whooshes past us. When you say she's dying, I begin. You mean she's got an incurable disease? Cancer, or leukemia or something? Oshima shakes his head. Could be. But I don't know anything about her health. For all I know, she might be saddled with a disease like that. I think it's more of a psychological issue. The will to live. Something to do with that. You're saying she's lost the will to live? I think so. Lost the will to go on living. Do you think she's going to kill herself? No, I don't, Oshima replies. It's just that very quietly, very steadily, she's heading towards death, or else death is heading towards her. Like a train heading towards the station. Something like that, Oshima said, and stopped, his lips taut. But then you showed up, Kafka. Cool as a cucumber, mysterious as the real Kafka. The two of you were drawn together, and, to use the classic expression, you have a relationship. And then? For a brief moment, Oshima lifts both hands off the wheel. That's it. I slowly shake my head. I bet you're thinking I'm the train. Oshima doesn't say anything for a long time. Exactly, he finally says. That's it, exactly. That I'm bringing about her death. I'm not blaming you for this, mind you, he says. It's actually for the best. Why? He doesn't answer this. You're supposed to find the answer to that, his silence tells me. Or maybe he's saying, it's too obvious to even think about. I lean back in my seat, shut my eyes, and let my body go limp. Oshima, what is it? I don't know what to do anymore. I don't even know what direction I'm facing in. What's right? What's wrong? Whether I should keep on going ahead or turn round? I'm totally lost. Ushima keeps silent, no answer forthcoming. You've got to help me. What am I supposed to do? I ask him. You don't have to do anything, he says simply. Nothing. He nods. Which is why I'm taking you to the mountains. But what should I do once I get there? Just listen to the wind, he says. That's what I always do. I mull this over. He gently lays a hand over mine. There are a lot of things that aren't your fault. Or mine, either. Not the fault of prophecies, or curses, or DNA, or absurdity. Not the fault of structuralism, or the Third Industrial Revolution. We all die and disappear. But that's because the mechanism of the world itself is built on destruction and loss. Our lives are just shadows of that guiding principle. Say the wind blows. It can be a strong, violent wind, or a gentle breeze. But eventually, every kind of wind dies out and disappears. Wind doesn't have form. It's just a movement of air. You should listen carefully, and then you'll understand the metaphor. I squeeze his hand back. It's soft and warm. His smooth, sexless, delicately graceful hand. So you think it's better for me to be away from Miss Sayaki for the time being? I do, Kafka. It's the best thing right now. We should let her be by herself. She's bright and tough. She's managed to put up with a terrible kind of loneliness for a long time, a lot of painful memories. She can make whatever decisions she needs to make alone. So I'm just a kid who's getting in the way. That's not what I mean, Ushima says softly. That's not it at all. You did what you had to do. What made sense to you and to her. Leave the rest up to her. This might sound cold, but there's nothing you can do for her now. You need to get into the mountains and do your own thing. For you, the time is right. Do my own thing. Just keep your ears open, Kafka, Ushima replied. Just listen. Imagine you're a clam.
36.
When he got back to the inn, Hoshino found Nakata, no surprise, still fast asleep. The bag he'd put next to him with bread and orange juice was untouched. The old man hadn't shifted an inch, probably hadn't woken up once the whole time. Hoshino counted the hours. Nakata had gone to sleep at 2 the previous afternoon, which meant he'd been asleep for 30 solid hours. What day is it, anyway? Hoshino wondered. He was losing track of time. He took his memo book out of his bag and checked. Let's see, he said to himself. We arrived in Tokushima on a Saturday on the bus from Kobe, then Nakata slept till Monday. On Monday we left Tokushima for Takamatsu. Thursday was all that ruckus with the stone and thunder, and that afternoon he went to sleep. So skip ahead one night, and that would make today Friday. It's as though the old guy came to Shikoku to attend some sleep festival. As on the night before, Hoshino took a bath, watched TV for a while, then climbed into his futon. Nakata was still breathing peacefully, sound asleep. Whatever, Hoshino thought. Just go with the flow. Let him sleep as much as he wants. No need to worry about that. And he himself fell asleep at 10:30. At 5 the next morning, the mobile phone in his bag went off, jolting him awake. Nakata was still out like a light. Hoshino reached for the phone.
Hello?
Mr. Hoshino, a man's voice.
Colonel Sanders?
Hoshino said, recognizing the voice. The very one. How's it hanging, sport?
Fine, I guess. But how'd you get this number? I didn't give it to you, and the phone's been turned off all this time, so those clowns from work won't bother me. So how could you call me? You're kind of freaking me out here.
It's like I told you, I'm neither a god nor a Buddha nor a human being. I'm something else again, a concept. So making your phone ring's a cinch, piece of cake. Whether it's turned on or not makes not one jot of difference, my friend. Don't let every little thing get to you, okay? I could have run over and been right there beside you when you woke up, but I thought that'd be a bit of a shock. You bet it would. Which explains the phone call. I'm a well-mannered person, after all.
I appreciate it, Oshino said. So, anyway, what are we supposed to do with the stone? Nakata and I managed to flip it over so that entrance thing opened up. Lightning was flashing like crazy outside, and the stone weighed a ton. Oh, that's right. I haven't told you about Nakata yet. He's the guy I'm traveling with.
I know all about Mr. Nakata, Colonel Sanders said. No need to explain.
You know about him? Oshino said. Okay.
Anyhow, Nakata went into hibernation after that, and the stone's still here. Don't you think we should get it back to the shrine? We might be cursed for taking it without permission.
You never give up, do you?
How many times did I tell you there's no curse? Colonel Sanders said disgustedly. Keep the stone there for the time being. You opened it up, and eventually you'll have to close it again. Then you can take it back. But it's not time for that yet. Get it? We okay here?
Yeah, I get it, Hoshino said. Things that are open have to be shut. Things you have, you've got to return the way they were.
All right.
Anyhow, I've decided not to think about things so much. I'll go along with whatever you want, no matter how crazy it sounds. I had a kind of revelation last night. Taking crazy things seriously is a serious waste of time.
A very wise conclusion. There's that saying, pointless thinking is worse than no thinking at all.
I like that.
Very suggestive, don't you think? Have you heard the saying, sheepish butler's surgical bottle battles?
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
It's a tongue twister. I made it up.
Your point being?
No point, really. I just felt like saying it.
Hush, you know, kill the stupid comments, all right? I don't have much patience with inanity. You'll drive me nuts if you keep that up.
Sorry, Hoshino said. But why'd you call me in the first place? He must have had a reason to call so early.
That's right. It completely slipped my mind, Colonel Sanders said. Here's the thing. I want you to leave that in right this minute. No time to eat breakfast. Just wake up Mr. Nakata, grab the stone, and get out. Get a cab, but don't have the inn call one for you. Go out to the main street and flag one down. Then give the driver this address. Do you have something to write with?
Yep, just a sec. Hoshino replied, grabbing a pen and his notebook from his bag. Broom and dustpan, check.
Enough with the stupid jokes, Colonel Sanders yelled into the phone. I'm serious here, not a minute to lose.
Okay, okay, go ahead.
Colonel Sanders recited the address, and Hoshino wrote it down, repeating it to make sure he got it right.
Apartment 308, Takamatsu Park Heights 16153 Chome. Is that it?
That's fine, Colonel Sanders replied. You'll find the key under a black umbrella stand at the front door. Unlock the door and go inside. You can stay there as long as you like. There's a stock of food and things, so you won't have to go out for the time being.
That's your place?
It is indeed. I don't own it, though. It's rented. So make yourself at home. I got the place for you two.
Colonel?
Yeah?
You told me you're not a god or a Buddha or a human being, correct?
Correct.
So I'm assuming you're not of this world.
You got it.
Then how could you rent an apartment? You're not human, so you don't have all the papers and stuff you need, right? A family register, local registration, proof of income, official stamp and seal and all that? If you don't have those, nobody's going to rent you a place. Did you cheat or something? Like change a leaf by magic into an official stamp? Enough underhanded stuff's gone on already. I don't want to get mixed up in any more.
You just don't get it, do you? Colonel Sanders said, clicking his tongue. You are one major dimwit. Is your brain made out of jelly, you spineless twit? A leaf? What do you think I am, one of those magical raccoons? I'm a concept, get it? Concept. Concepts and raccoons aren't exactly the same now, are they? What a dumb thing to say. Do you really think I went over to the estate agents, filled out all the forms, bargained with them to lower the rent? Ridiculous. I have a secretary to take care of temporal things. My secretary gets all the necessary documents and things together. What do you expect?
Oh, so you have a secretary.
Damn right I do. Who do you think I am, anyway? You're way out of line. I'm a busy man, so why shouldn't I have a secretary?
All right, don't blow a gasket. I was just pulling your leg. Anyway, why do we have to leave so fast? Can't we at least have a bite before we go? I'm starving, and Mr. Nakata's out like a light. I couldn't wake him up no matter how hard I try.
Listen, this is no joke. The police are scouring the town for you. First thing this morning, they've been making the rounds of hotels and inns, questioning everyone. They've already got a description of the two of you. So once they start nosing around, it's only a matter of time. The two of you stand out, let's face it. There's not a moment to lose. The police? Hoshino shouted. Give me a break. We haven't done anything wrong. Sure, I ripped off a few motorcycles back in high school. Just joyriding. It wasn't as if I was going to sell them or anything. I always took them back. Never done anything illegal since. Taking that stone from the shrine is about the worst thing I've done, and you told me to. This has nothing to do with the stone, Colonel Saunders said flatly. You're a real dunce sometimes. Forget the stone. The police don't know anything about it and wouldn't give a damn if they did. They're not going to be up at the crack of dawn beating down doors over some stone. We're talking something much more serious. What do you mean? The police are after Mr. Nakata because of it.
I don't get it. He's the last person you'd ever imagine committing a crime. What kind of crime? And how could he be involved?
No time to go into that now. You have to get him out of there. Everything depends on you. Are we clear here?
I don't get it, Hoshino repeated, shaking his head. It just doesn't make any sense. So they're going to finger me as an accomplice?
No, but I'm sure they'll question you. Time's a-wasting. Don't bother your head over it now. Just do as I say.
Listen, you have to understand one thing about me. I hate the police. They're worse than the Yakuza, worse than the SDF. They're awful, the things they do. They strut around and love nothing more than tormenting the weak. I had plenty of run-ins with the police when I was in high school, even after I started driving lorries, so the last thing I needed to get into a fight with them. There's no way you can win, plus you can't shake them off afterwards. You know what I mean? God, how'd I get mixed up in all this? You see, what I... The line went dead. Jeez, Hoshino said.
He sighed deeply and tossed the mobile phone into his bag, then tried to wake Nakata up.
Hey, Mr. Nakata, cramps, fire, flood, earthquake, revolution, Godzilla's on the loose. Get up!
It was some time before Nakata woke up.
I finished the beveling, he said. The rest I used as kindling. No, cats don't take baths. I'm the one who took the bath.
Obviously in his own little world. Hoshino shook the old man's shoulder, pinched his nose, tugged at his ears, and finally roused him to the land of the living.
Is that you, Mr. Hoshino? He asked.
Yeah, it's me, Hoshino replied. Sorry to wake you up.
No problem. Nakata was going to get up soon anyway. Don't worry about it. I finished with the kindling.
Good. But something's come up, something not so good, and we have to get out of here right now.
Is it about Johnny Walker?
That I don't know. I've got my sources, and they told me we'd better make ourselves scarce. The police are after us.
Is that right?
That's what he said. But what happened with you and this Johnny Walker guy?
Didn't Nakata already tell you?
No, you didn't.
I feel as though I did, though.
No, you never told me the most important part.
Well, what happened was Nakata killed him.
You have to be kidding.
No, I'm not.
Jeez, Louise, Hoshino muttered.
Hoshino threw his belongings into his bag and wrapped the stone back up in its cloth. It was the same weight as it had been originally. Not light, but at least he could carry it. Nakata put his things in his canvas bag. Hoshino went to the front desk and told them something had come up suddenly and they had to check out. Since he'd paid in advance, it didn't take long. Nakata was still a bit unsteady on his feet, but he could walk.
How long did I sleep? He asked.
Let me see, Hoshino said, doing the maths. About 40 hours, give or take.
I feel I slept well.
No wonder. If you don't feel refreshed after that kind of record-breaking sleep, then sleep's kind of pointless, isn't it? Hey, you hungry?
Yes, I am. Very hungry.
Can you hold off for a while? First we have to get out of here as soon as we can. Then we'll eat.
That's all right. I can wait.
Hoshino helped him out onto the main street and flagged down a taxi. He told the driver the address, and the driver nodded and sped off. The taxi left the city, drove down a main thoroughfare and into a suburb. The neighborhood was chic and quiet, a real contrast from the noisy area near the station where they'd been staying. The journey took about 25 minutes. They stopped in front of a typical 5-story, neat-as-a-pin apartment building. Takamatsu Park Heights, the sign said, though it was on a level expanse with no park in sight. They took the lift up to the second floor, where Hoshino found the key, sure enough, under the umbrella stand. The apartment was a standard 2-bedroom place, with a kitchen diner, a living room, and a bathroom. The place was brand new by the looks of it, the furniture barely used. The living room contained a widescreen TV, a small stereo, a sofa and love seat, and each bedroom had a bed already made up. The kitchen had the usual utensils, the shelves stocked with a passable set of plates, cups and bowls. There were smart-looking framed prints on the walls, and the whole place looked like some model apartment a developer might keep to show new clients.
"Not bad at all," Hoshino remarked. "Not much character, but at least it's clean."
"It's very pretty," Nagata added.
The large off-white fridge was packed with food. Muttering to himself, Nagata looked at everything, finally taking out some eggs, a green pepper, and butter. He rinsed off the pepper, sliced it into thin strips, and sauteed it. Next he broke the eggs into a bowl and whipped them up with chopsticks. He pulled out a frying pan and proceeded to make 2 green pepper omelets with a practiced touch. He topped this off with toast and took the meal over to the dining table, along with hot tea.
"You're quite the cook," Hoshino said. "I'm impressed."
"I've always lived alone, so I'm used to it."
"I live alone too, but don't ask me to cook anything, 'cause I stink at it."
"Nakata has a lot of free time and nothing else to do."
The two of them ate their toast and omelets. They were still hungry, so Nakata went back to the kitchen and sautéed some bacon and spinach, which they had with 2 more slices of toast each. Starting to feel human again, they sank back on the sofa and had a second cup of tea.
"So," Hoshino said, "you killed somebody, huh?"
"Yes, I did," Nakata answered, and gave a detailed account of how he had stabbed Johnny Walker to death.
"Man alive," Hoshino said when he'd finished. "What a freaky story. The police would never believe that, no matter how honest you are about it." "I mean, I believe you, but if you'd told me that a week ago, I would have sent you packing."
"I don't understand it myself.
At any rate, somebody's been murdered, and murder's not something you just shrug off. The police aren't fooling around on this one, not if they've trailed you out here to Shikoku."
"Nakata, sorry you had to get involved."
"Aren't you going to give yourself up?"
"No, I'm not," Nakata said, with uncharacteristic firmness. "I already tried that, but right now I don't feel like doing so. There are some other things Nakata has to do. Otherwise it's pointless for me to have come all this way."
"You have to close that entrance again."
"That's right. Things that are open have to be shut. Then I will be normal again. But there are some things Nakata has to take care of first."
"Colonel Sanders, the guy who told me where the stone is," Hoshino said, "is helping us lie low. But why is he doing this? Is there some connection between him and Johnny Walker?"
The more Hoshino tried to unravel it, though, the more confused he got. Better not to try to make sense, he decided, of what basically doesn't make any.
"Pointless thinking is worse than no thinking at all," he concluded out loud, arms crossed.
"Mr. Hoshino," Nakata said.
"What's up?"
"I smell the sea."
Hoshino went to the window, opened it, went out onto the narrow veranda, and breathed in deeply. No sea smells that he could detect. In the distance, white summer clouds floated above a pine forest.
"I don't smell anything," he said.
Nakata came over beside him and started sniffing, his nose twitching like a squirrel.
"I can. The sea's right over there." He pointed to the forest.
"You've got quite a nose there," Hoshino said. "I got a touch of sinus problem myself, so I'm always a bit stuffed up."
"Mr. Hoshino, why don't we walk over to the ocean?"
Hoshino thought about it. How could a little walk on the beach hurt?
"Okay, let's go."
"Nakata has to take a dump first, if it's all right."
"Take your time, we're in no rush."
While Nakata was in the toilet, Hoshino walked around the apartment, checking it out. Like the colonel said, there was pretty much everything they needed. Shaving cream in the bathroom, two new toothbrushes, cotton buds, plasters, nail clippers,